Would you please stand to honor God's word? We'll be reading, the scripture for today is from the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 28, verses 1 to 10, and it's on page 989 for those of you who are reading from the Bibles that are probably in front of you. Again, Matthew 28, verses 1 through 10. After the Sabbath, at dawn, on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven and, going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning, and his clothes were white as snow. The guards were so afraid of him that they shook and became like dead men. The angel said to the women, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He has risen, just as he said. Come and see the place where he lay. Then go quickly and tell his disciples, 'He has risen from the dead and is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him. Now I have told you.'" So the women hurried away from the tomb, afraid yet filled with joy, and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly, Jesus met them. "Greetings," he said. They came to him, clasped his feet, and worshiped him. Then Jesus said to them, "Do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me." This is the word of the Lord. Would you please be seated?
Tell me of the God I thought I knew. Tell me of the God I never knew. Jesus, let me rediscover you. If you want to rediscover Jesus, or maybe discover who he is for the very first time this morning, together we must learn to stop tinkering with the tomb and start trusting the promise. There's an interesting verse in Scripture, Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 5. When I first read this verse, I thought that would never happen to me. I don't know who God is talking to here, but it just seems ridiculous, the claim that's being made. If it really could happen to someone, I think they must be, you know, weak or just intellectually not there. Because Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 5 says, "Look at the nations and watch," God declares. "Look at the nations and watch, and be utterly amazed, for I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told." Really? You were going to do something if you told me? I mean, if God told me that he was going to do something, I think I would believe it. Well, this happened to me. Not God speaking to me, but someone very credible told me that something was going to happen, and I didn't believe it. I totally missed it. It's a little something I like to call driving to SeaWorld in the rain. We were just recently on a vacation down in Florida, and we stay in Cape Canaveral because we are beach people. We love going to the beach, but it's fun to get over to Orlando and visit some of the theme parks. And I'd had the vacation meticulously planned. Every minute, the fun that we were going to be having moment by moment. My wife will tell you I'm not as relaxed as I come off, okay? She says, "You seem really relaxed, but you're not." Thanks, Neen. But I like to have a plan. I like to know what's going on. And so I had the vacation planned out, and everything was good, except there was this one day when it was supposed to rain. So I checked all sorts of weather forecasting models. We're in Cape Canaveral, so you can visit NASA. I spoke with some astronauts. I just downloaded a few apps on my phone, but similar. I downloaded these apps, And I checked all the weather from all these different vantage points, and I thought, I think the rain is going to just go south of Orlando. It's going to hit, you know, from Tampa all the way to Cape Canaveral. But I think there's a little window in Orlando where we can sneak into SeaWorld and have a grand day on our vacation. So we load up the kids. We're driving, you know, across half of the state of Florida with three kids and snacks and everything. And I even, to show you how much faith I had that my weather forecasting was going to be correct, I had so much faith, I strapped the stroller onto the outside. I hung the stroller on the bike rack. I don't know why I did that. I just thought, you know, I'm really gonna go for it here. But it proved to be not a good move. When about halfway down the highway, the clouds were dark. The rain came down. I mean, the highway, people were going 20 miles an hour on the highway. It was just a downpour, a deluge of rain just coming down. And Nina just kind of looks at me. And she says, "You knew that." I said, "Well, I mean, kind of. I looked at a few things that may have said that it was going to rain." And we show up at the park. Here's a picture of us showing up at the park. You can see the parking lot attendant in the poncho and the umbrella. You see someone off on the right scurrying out. People are scurrying out of the park in ponchos. And someone actually did hand us two ponchos as we were going in and say, "Good luck." You see, the resurrection of Jesus is a Habakkuk 1:5 moment for everyone. It's like driving to SeaWorld in the rain when everyone knew, based on the weather forecast, that it was going to rain. Because throughout the gospel, Jesus has told everyone explicitly what the plan is, how he will conquer sin and death. He starts in Matthew chapter 12. Verse 40, and we've been walking through the whole Gospel of Matthew. If you're just joining us here on Easter Sunday, for the past 6 weeks, we've been on this journey through the Gospel of Matthew, looking at these five large sections of teaching that Jesus has in the Gospel. They're called the five discourses of Jesus. And we noticed, as we walk through the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus starts talking openly about his death and resurrection all the way back in chapter 12, verse 40, chapter 16, chapter 17, chapter 20. They all say the same thing. Let me just summarize it for you. We are going to go to Jerusalem. I'll be crucified. I'll be dead. But 3 days later, I will rise from the grave. He made it plain to them. To his disciples, and back in chapter 12, he's speaking to the Pharisees, to his disciples, and to the religious leaders as well. There is no secret. Jesus is going to Jerusalem to be killed and then to demonstrate his power, his authority over even death itself, and to rise from the grave. He said it. Yet, when you read what happened in the Gospel of Matthew, the disciples are nowhere to be found at the resurrection. A man actually identified as one of Jesus' followers, he's the one that's actually rolling the rock in front of the tomb, a man named Joseph of Arimathea. We'll look at him later. He's a follower of Jesus. He says, "Well, this is over," and he rolls a rock in front of the tomb, as if Jesus never mentioned rising from the dead. To top it off, people are wide-eyed and mystified when the resurrection actually takes place. Believers and non-believers are terrified and in some cases fainting when Jesus rises from the dead. "Behold, I am about to do something in your days that you would not believe even if you were told." If you want to rediscover Jesus, or maybe discover him for the very first time, stop tinkering with the tomb and start trusting the promise. As we walk through our pastor scripture, what I want to do is I want to introduce us to three people in the story. Give us three words to describe these people, and then we'll leave with one challenge. Three people, three words, and one challenge. The first person is Joseph of Arimathea, who I mentioned earlier. His story can be found just before what Doug read in chapter 27. Let me read it to you. Chapter 27, verses 57 through 60. "As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away." You see how Joseph is tinkering with the tomb? You see how he's saying, okay, Jesus is dead. So what are we going to do now? And he goes, well, I bought this plot maybe for me, maybe for my wife, maybe for one of my family members. I've already got it all together. I've actually hewn the rock myself. It means he cut this tomb out of this cave himself. He said, you know, I guess we can use it for Jesus. And because this is over, you see, Joseph is the one. He rolls the stone right in front of the tomb. He's tinkering with the tomb. And I have one word to describe Joseph here as he does his tinkering with the tomb. He's respectful. It's a respectful thing with the tomb. You see, as the custom was in Jewish law, a criminal would normally just be left hung there on, they would just be left on the cross. And vultures could come and eat at their flesh. Jesus, and Joseph said, I'm not going to have that happen to Jesus. So he does the respectful thing. He takes him down off the cross. He takes his body. It says he takes a new, fresh linen cloth. It's so respectful. He says, I'm going to give my teacher a proper burial. He's respectful, but he's not expecting. He's respectful of who Jesus is. He's respectful of what Jesus has done, but he's not expecting Jesus to do any more. Are you merely respectful of Jesus this morning? Let me tell you a story in my life about being a little bit disrespectful that scared me into respect, good habits. I went to a school where there was a dress code. And you always had to have a collared shirt, and your collared shirt had to be tucked in, and you had to wear a belt to pull it all together. And for some reason, as a little eighth grader, wearing that belt was just too much for me. Just wanted to have a little bit of a rebellious streak in me. So I put the collared shirt on, I tucked it in, but I never wore a belt. No one ever said anything. No one ever said anything to me until one time I was sitting in the hallway doing some homework and the head of school walked by. It's a man named Dr. Vito, and I thought I was just being polite. I raised my hand. I said, good afternoon, Dr. Vito. He said, where's your belt? I said, I don't wear a belt, Dr. Vito. And he said, that's disrespectful, detention. I had to go to Saturday morning detention. It was devastating. He said, that's disrespectful. And I thought, what? They're just like little strips of fabric. They're just little strips of fabric against another strip of fabric without anything in between. I don't see what's so disrespectful about my little strips of fabric without anything between the other strip of fabric, Dr. Vito. But he said, that's disrespectful. And that Saturday morning in detention, I'll tell you, I never want to spend another Saturday of my life like that again. And so I put the belt on. I started doing respectful things. And you know what? That can happen to us with God oftentimes. Something happens in our life. We go, oh, I better straighten up. I better get respectful. I better make sure I'm saying grace before every meal. I better make sure that I'm going to church on Sunday. I better make sure, you know, I'm doing, telling my kids, you know, that there is a God and that you should follow them and you should believe and that you should pray with them. Maybe it's about believing Jesus is just a good moral teacher. So many people get around the whole Jesus as the resurrected Lord of the universe by saying, you know, Jesus is a good moral teacher. That's my understanding of him. I show respect to Jesus because I believe Jesus is a good moral teacher. You know what? Jesus wants more than our respect. He wants more than us saying grace before a meal or showing up on Sunday out of obligation or explaining away his resurrection by believing that he's a good moral teacher. Jesus wants more than your tacit respect. He wants to transform you through the power of his resurrection that is available to all who believe. So stop respectfully tinkering with the tomb and let's start trusting the promise. The guards in the story. The guards, their story is in Matthew chapter 27, verses 62 through 66. And it says this about these guards. The next day, this is after Joseph puts him in the tomb. The next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days, I will rise again.' So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first." "Take a guard," Pilate answered. "Go," listen to this, "make the tomb as secure as you know how." So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting a guard. You see, they're tinkering with the tomb. They're putting a seal around it. Pilate says, "Make it as secure as you know how. Lock it up," and I mean lock it up. And they go and they do everything they know how to do, these guards, and they put a seal around it, and they're touching the tomb, and they're messing with the tomb, and it's all about how secure they can make the tomb. They're tinkering with the tomb, but they're not doing it in a respectful way. They're tinkering with the tomb, here's my word for the guards, in a fearful way. They're fearful, these guards. They're fearful that if Jesus actually is who he said he was, that that's going to have some pretty big implications for who's in charge around the Roman Empire, for what Pilate's power and authority really is, and how limited it becomes, how they might actually have to change and adjust the way they live their lives because they have just beaten Jesus. They've spat on him. And if he actually raises from the dead and is who he says he was, oh, there are going to be some deep implications to that. And so they're so fearful, they seal the tomb. Are you fearful of what the implications are for your life if Jesus were to really rise from the dead? Is there a situation in your life where your heart is so close to it that you actually want it to remain dead? You're saying, "I've got a dead relationship, but you know what? I'm not willing to work on it. I'm not willing to attempt to reconcile. I'm not going to do the hard work that it's going to take to pick up the phone and have that awkward conversation to admit that I was wrong." Maybe it's a habit that you're stuck on in your life. You're saying this habit is comfortable. I'm in a routine. Maybe it's a relationship with alcohol that you have that's destructive in your own life, and you're saying, "You know what? If Jesus really did rise from the dead and he can satisfy my needs more than alcohol or this other habit, then I'm actually gonna have to work on getting this habit out of my life. And I'm not quite sure I'm ready to do that." What is it for you that you want to remain inside that tomb? And what we end up doing is we tinker with the tomb. We try to make it as secure as possible to keep Jesus dead at all costs. And I'll tell you why. Because a dead Jesus is a safe Jesus. A dead Jesus makes no claim on our lives, asks nothing from us. A dead Jesus is a safe Jesus. So we put the seal around the tomb and we tinker with it in a fearful way. But let's look what happens. Let's look at the result. What happens when we fearfully tinker with the tomb? When Jesus is raised from the dead, and this is on into what Doug read, Matthew chapter 28, I want to read verses 1-4, and look at what happens to the guards who fearfully tinker with the tomb. After the Sabbath, at dawn on the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to look at the tomb. There was a violent earthquake, for an angel of the Lord came down from heaven, and going to the tomb, rolled back the stone and sat on it. His appearance was like lightning. His clothes were white as snow. This is what happened to the guards. The guards were so afraid that they shook and became like dead men. What happens to the guards? The guards become dead. Jesus is alive. Jesus is alive with power to spare. And the people that tried to seal the tomb, that tried to keep their habit hidden or their fears secure, they end up dead. They end up not experiencing that power, and the analogy that I would use to us this day is we will end up on a slow path towards death ourselves, whether it's death relationally or death in our own hearts or in our own minds. That's what happens when we fearfully tinker with the tomb. Jesus is alive with power to spare, and we end up the ones who are dead. C.S. Lewis wrote a letter to a friend of his whose wife had been diagnosed with cancer. And in the letter, C.S. Lewis, who had gone through a tragedy in his own life with his wife passing away, wrote to encourage his friend. We are not necessarily doubting that God will do the best for us. We are wondering how painful the best will turn out to be. And so often, that's where we are this morning when we try to seal the tomb. We know that God has a better plan for our lives than we could come up with our own, but we're wondering how much we're gonna have to give up in order to follow that plan, how painful it's actually gonna be for Jesus to transform us. And so we tinker with the tomb. We try to make it secure. But this morning, let's stop respectfully and fearfully tinkering with the tomb. And let's look at the third character in the story. It's two people, the two Marys, and what word we might have to describe them. The story of the two Marys is back in chapter 27, verse 61. Just one simple verse, and then it picks up again in the passage that Doug read, 28, 1 to 10. But let's just look at 27, 61. One simple verse, story of two Marys, Mary Magdalene, and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. As Joseph is tinkering with the tomb, as Joseph is rolling the stone in front of the tomb, what are the two Marys doing? They're sitting there opposite the tomb. They're staring at it. They're wondering what might happen. Is he really who he said he was? They're not touching the tomb. They're not doing anything but looking at the tomb and wondering. And then you see the first day of the week, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary, it says they came in chapter 28, verse 1, to look at the tomb. They just wanted to look at it again. They're not tinkering. They're not touching it. They're waiting. They're watching. And maybe even they're just a bit hopeful that Jesus might actually be who he said he was. And everything that he said all throughout the gospel may just come true. Now we learn later that they too have to be told on multiple occasions not to be afraid. When the angel shows up, he says to the women, "Don't be afraid." And then when Jesus actually meets them, as they're running back to tell the disciples, Jesus has to tell them again, "Don't be afraid." But you look, their fear is actually mixed. Their fear is mixed with an edge of joy to it. It says they were afraid yet filled with joy. And they're running. They're running back to tell the disciples. Because as Joseph was respectful but not expecting, these women, they are hopeful and expecting who Jesus is true. And they're running back to these disciples. And I think that shows their hope in the midst of this situation. You see, they know, the two Marys, they know what we all must learn, that God is at work in the dark. Even in the darkness of death, God is at work. On the front cover of Time magazine, which is dated tomorrow, is an article about understanding how God works in the dark. And this is a quote from that article. The preacher and Taylor points out that darkness was often the setting for humanity's closest encounters with the divine. God appeared to Abraham in the night and promised him descendants more numerous than the stars. The Exodus from Egypt happened at night. God met Moses in thick darkness atop Mount Sinai to hand down the Ten Commandments. The Apostle Paul's conversion happened after he lost his sight. Jesus was born beneath a star and resurrected in the darkness of a cave. If we turn away from darkness on principle, she asks, doing everything we can to avoid it because there is simply no telling what it contains. Isn't there a chance we are running away from God? See, the women, they learn what we all must learn, that God is at work in the dark, even in the darkness of death. And so here's the challenge. Stop either respectfully or fearfully tinkering with the tomb and start trusting the promise of Jesus's words. Look with me at verse 5 of Matthew chapter 28. When the angel speaks to the women, he says, "Do not be afraid, for I know that you are looking for Jesus who was crucified. He is not here. He is risen." And here it is. He is risen just as he said. Stop tinkering with the tomb and let's start trusting in the promise of Jesus' words. He's risen just as he said. Remember all those verses of Jesus predicting his death and his resurrection. You see, we've been on this journey, as Elizabeth Duncan mentioned, from Ash Wednesday up to now, preparing for this moment when we would celebrate Jesus' resurrection. We thought that if we prepared for it, we might see it in new ways. And we've used a devotional called Lent for Everyone by a guy named N.T. Wright that walks through the Gospel of Matthew and offers some devotional thoughts on it. And we picked the right book because N.T. Wright was featured on the cover of Christianity Today. We're reading something that's a part of the larger conversation that churches all over America are having. And in this article, when N.T. Wright talks about the resurrection of Jesus, and this idea that he rose just as he said, N.T. Wright notes, "God is acting in a surprising new way, as he always told us he would do." I love that. God is acting in a surprising new way, as he always told us he would do. "Behold, look at the nations. Be utterly amazed, for I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told." Now, what happens when you do this? What happens when you stop respectfully or fearfully tinkering with the tomb and start trusting the promise of Jesus' words? What happens? Well, what happens is what happens to the women. They meet the resurrected Jesus. Their fear is addressed. Their entire life begins a process of transformation called discipleship. This is why Jesus tells them to go back to Galilee, to meet him, to tell the disciples and to meet them in Galilee, because this is where it all began. Earlier in the gospel, you would read that these women actually started following Jesus from Galilee. Jesus is saying, go back to where everything started. That will give you a chance to rediscover me. Or to maybe discover me for the first time. When we got back from our vacation, it was the first day I had to go back to work. I'd spent 9 days with my family, every moment in togetherness, family meals. We were never apart. And the first day that I went back to work and came home, Olivia and Sophie were in the bath when I walked in, and I walked in, and Olivia's face, there was just like shock on her face. I said, "Hi, Olivia." And she said, "Daddy, we forgot all about you." This is the kind of thing that happens to us as well. We say, "Jesus, we forgot all about you. We forgot all about what you said. We forgot all about the power you possess. We forgot about the call you've placed on our lives, the love you have for us, the desire you have to be in relationship with us." So this morning, if you have forgotten about Jesus, or maybe never had him in your heart or mind, stop tinkering with the tomb and start trusting the promise of Jesus' words. "For he has risen, just as he said." Let's stand and declare that promise together.